Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, wildlife filmmaking in the era of Attenborough. Terry Flanagan checks out the bird species present on the grounds of Áras an Uachtaráin, and John Bella Riley goes forest bathing in County Wicklow.
So we're surrounded here by the most beautiful nature. We have the river behind us, and we've got the beautiful trees all around us with the moss and the ferns. So we're not separate from nature, we're part of nature.
And just to tell you that all of the material you hear in this programme was recorded prior to the coronavirus COVID-19 outbreak. You can visit the website anytime you like, which is rte.ie/Mooney. While you're there, you can have a look back at our very extensive archive and listen to some of our radio documentaries. One of them was called The Bergen Whale, which told the story of a Cuvier's beaked whale, which was stranded on the island of Sotra, close to the city of Bergen, on the southwestern coast of Norway.
The interesting thing is that this wasn't the first whale that ever came to our shores. This happens every other year, maybe perhaps with an Olympic interval, but this time was the first time that such a magnificent creature, which they are, and which people come to Norway to see after all as tourists, it was the first time a whale came here, and it became apparent that we killed it. It came here and it came into a small little beach just outside Bergen, and very publicly was put down with a rifle in front of a lot of people. And as soon as we opened it, we saw that we had murdered it with plastic. It was so full in its stomach that it had just choked on plastic. And there's no way around this. We killed this poor creature. Magnificent sea creature that should be there to sort of remind us of the excellence of nature, and now had to be put down, go outside an oil refinery, funnily enough. This, of course, caused an outcry, not only in Norway, but in the world, as the media attention would show later.
That whale was still clinging to life when discovered, but it was in very poor health and suffering greatly. And after several unsuccessful attempts to coax it back out to sea failed, the difficult decision was made to put the poor creature out of its misery. Well, we got a lot of response to that particular documentary, and similarly, the BBC wildlife series Blue Planet 2 did much to raise awareness about the impact of human behaviour on the environment and was seen by many as a call to arms on plastic pollution.
Plastic has become an integral part of our daily lives, but every year some 8 million tonnes of it ends up in the ocean, and there it can be lethal.
David Attenborough's most recent appearance in a BBC wildlife television series marks a drastic departure from any previous one. With seven worlds, one planet, we're witnessing a turn in the history of wildlife television broadcasting, the inclusion of climate change in the narrative. So writes Jean-Baptiste Guillon, associate professor at the Department of Science and Technology Studies in the Faculty of Maths and Physical Sciences in University College London. Here's a clip from Seven Worlds, One Planet, in which wildlife cameraman John Acheson tells us how albatross chicks are being fatally blown from their nests by stronger and stronger storms intensified by climate change.
The problem is now, it's becoming so windy that the chicks are actually getting blown off the nests. So there's a bird that lives by the wind that's now suffering as the wind's getting too strong for them.
Jean-Baptiste Guillon references this clip in his article Why Wildlife Television is Finally Engaging with a Climate Emergency.
Derek, I'm really looking forward to meeting Jean-Baptiste Guillon. Beautiful French name. And he's a Frenchman. He's a French philosopher of science here at University College London. Being French, he will be the man to talk to, because wildlife depictions, the first representation of wildlife, occurred in France.
Did it?
Yes, yes. Go to Lascaux, which is in the Dordogne. It's a cave which has on its walls depictions of mammoths, giant deers, our Irish deer, for instance, saber-toothed tigers. Millennia ago, tens of millennia ago, people went into caves in the south of France, mm-hmm, for reasons unknown, and they depicted animals on the walls. And there was one discovered relatively recently, Chauvet. And Chauvet is 30,000 years since the men worked on the walls of that depicting animals. So the great tradition begins there, and it goes on right into Europe. You have Dürer's famous picture of a rhinoceros, which was for a time the most famous wildlife depiction of all, I suppose. He was German, of course, but right down onto the television of our own day. So this is a great tradition, and it begins in France, and we're talking to a Frenchman about it.
Very welcome, Richard, to University College London.
Thank you, Jean-Baptiste.
Richard Collins and I travelled to University College in London recently to meet with Jean-Baptiste and discuss his recent book, BBC Wildlife Documentaries in the Age of Attenborough.
Go back to Lascaux to start
yes.
with. So your predecessors presenting material to the public, what was their intention in doing so? What were they at?
So I think it would be wrong to try and give a definite answer to that mm-hmm. question, because in fact no one knows why they were painting those pictures. But one thing is for sure is that it enabled them to make sense of the world they were living in, and especially to make sense of the animals with which they shared the planet, and which to them were either a source of food, so a source of life, or a threat to their lives. So they meant death as well. So I think that's the most we can say about those paintings, that they were a part of how people were making sense of life and the world they were living in at the time.
So animals were important to them, and they had a relationship with animals. Animals were not just objects out there like trees and stones and things. They were special, just as they are with you today.
Yes, they were. And I think the main shared characteristic between those early humans and those animals were the fact that they were alive. And so they could, I suppose, see that those animals were having behaviors which were quite similar to those they were themselves experiencing as humans. So I think it's a case of recognizing a shared condition, that of living on in an environment and perhaps being also mortal and trying to make sense of, come to terms with that condition, which is the finitude of life on Earth, I suppose.
So the next image that comes to mind talking to you is Dürer's rhinoceros of a few centuries ago. He depicted a rhinoceros beautifully.
Yeah,
so you're in that tradition. The French move on into that tradition, Dürer German, and so on, right up to today, the representing of animals. This is not new, you know. Television documentaries are ancient, really. It's just the medium that's changed, would you agree?
Yes, I agree that pictorial depictions of animals are not something new. In fact, they are, as you say, something which goes back to the origins of humanity. But I think what is specific to wildlife television is the storytelling imperative. Because, I mean, you could argue that a representation like Dürer's representation of a rhinoceros tells a story, which is basically told by any person looking at the picture. And it may be different stories depending on who is looking at it. Whereas the intent of a wildlife filmmaker is to construct a story visually, and a story which will be received as being the same whoever looks at the film, I think. So maybe that's the contribution of wildlife television to that long story of our history of representing animals visually, is to include the narrative or storytelling imperative to that kind of representations, I think.
So it's a kind of marriage in a way, because you have the literary tradition. There is a long tradition of animal fables that go back, but they are written or spoken, and then you have the pictures, and with you, with photography, with television, the two are brought together and fused for the first time. Is that a possible model of this?
Yeah, I quite like that summary of the evolution and origins of wildlife film. And I think what is also interesting in that summary is that Aesop's fables, which became La Fontaine fables in France, which every school children in France has to learn one of them, they have a moralizing function. And they say something about humans by talking about animals. So, and I think the same could be said about wildlife films, that they are in fact a way of talking about ourselves. And then we go back to the representations in the caves, which are also an interrogation of the human condition, I suppose, and through the examination of animals.
So we never see animals at all. We really see them as humans. We project human qualities onto them. We have no real experience of animals in themselves. We are a humanized version of animals. Is that a possible model?
Yes, I agree, because I think the main reason for that is that we are humans and we don't have any other ways of apprehending the world. So we inevitably placate humans' perceptions, ideas, desires on animals, and that's how all the categories we use to make sense of the world are derived from our human condition. So the charge of anthropomorphism, which is often made against wildlife films, is in fact something which is somehow inevitable, and it is a false problem, I think, because there is no other option than being anthropomorphic. Even a field scientist, a field biologist observing primates in the field will be placating human emotions in order to make sense of what they witness, because that's the only way we have to make sense of the world, basically.
Coming forward a little bit, the very first television wildlife documentaries that I'm aware of are the Zoo Quest ones of David Attenborough, in which he used to get a keeper from London Zoo, and they would go out and they flew out to South America, to Africa, to the Far East, and they captured animals and they brought them back and they dragged them into the studio afterwards and talked. This is where the formal subject of wildlife filming begins, is it? Or is there anyone ahead of that?
You could say that the filming of animals starts with cinema itself, because they were amongst the first subjects which were filmed by early filmmakers. Edward Muybridge very famously produced proto-films of horses, for instance. Etienne Jules Marais, who was a French physiologist, also filmed animals when he started assembling the technology of what would become cinema and the motion picture camera. That was at the end of the 19th century, but if we go a bit forward in time and then we go to Britain, there is a series which was called Secrets of Nature, which was produced by Mary Field and Percy Smith, which was about animals as well, which involved zoo animals, and which was seen as a way of educating the public about the life sciences and biology. And also, very famously, Gene Huxley was a promoter of the use of film as a way of advertising wildlife and biology to wider audiences. So his Private Life of the Gannets, which was partly filmed by John Grierson, the creator of documentary, was a wildlife film in itself, also won an Oscar, which led General Huxley to often quip during his lifetime that he was the only biologist who had won an Oscar.
Seen from the air, Grassholm reveals itself as an isolated 20 acres of rock surrounded by sea. Although its coastline is entirely rock-bound, most of its surface is covered with the rich grass from whose green it derived its name. But to the northwest, the green is replaced by white, almost like snow. As you draw closer, the white patch resolves itself into a dazzling assembly of great white birds at their breeding place, acres of them. The birds in their nests are draped and garlanded about the rocky slopes and have invaded the smoother ground above, where they have killed the grass, leaving only bare soil. They're spread like a sheet over the surface. Thousands of them, on and on.
So that's pre-Second World War, if you want. Secrets of Nature is something which ran from 1922 to 1933, and then there was a second series which ran from 1934 to the early 50s. But yes, Zoo Quest was somehow a new thing when it comes to wildlife filmmaking, primarily because it was made for television. And before Zoo Quest, I mean, there had been attempts at showing wildlife films on television, but they hadn't necessarily been made for television. I've written a book recently which is about the history of wildlife television in Britain, and in it I look at Zoo Quest, and I think one of the main contributions of this series was to try and tell stories visually, because they came at a time when television was really trying to develop a visual culture and to develop visual means of storytelling, as opposed to radio, which is entirely sound-based. So for a time, early on in television, people were dependent on the spoken word, but they quickly came to realize, and Attenborough was part of this period, that showing things was absolutely crucial.
Now, this is a genre, an artistic genre in a way. You can trace the development of a particular era of painting. Yes. Well, now, could you trace for us in a brief way, I know it's an impossible task, the development of this genre from those early days right up to today? How has it, what key ideas have come in? What has transformed it?
As you say, it's an almost unanswerable question, but I will try. Let's assume that a starting point is the ZooQuest series, because they were, as I said, something which was televisual, if you want, in its approach to the topic. Approximately at the same time and slightly before, Peter Scott had made his appearance on television screens, but his contribution was to show films which he had shot for his lectures, for instance, and basically he reproduced on television his lectures, his natural history lectures. But I think the main driving force of the development of wildlife television has been the desire by wildlife broadcasters to really develop their own professional culture and to make a place for themselves within the confines of natural history. And they've been eager from the late 50s onward to demonstrate that through television, through wildlife filmmaking, they could produce some kind of natural historical knowledge, which could then be shared by broader audiences, if you want. A key person there was Desmond Hawkins, who created the BBC Natural History Unit in Bristol and was very keen on instilling in people a taste and an appreciation for wildlife through the medium of television. There is this driving force, which is the development of a professional culture, and there is also the necessity for wildlife filmmakers to position themselves in relation to scientists and people who study animals in the wild, which is something which developed alongside wildlife television, in fact, because Huxley for a long time was the only one advocating field studies of animals. And this is something which became much more prominent in the 50s and 60s, 70s, notably through the work of Nico Tinbergen and Conrad Lorenz. Desmond Morris is part of this story as well, as one of the first PhD students which came out of Oxford with Nico Tinbergen, and he himself became a television personality. So if we take those two things, development of a professional culture, practice and mastery of the filmmaking apparatus and relationship with scientists, I think we move slowly towards what wildlife television has become now, which is something which is extremely cinematic. So increasingly it has become about making films, which are visual objects, which tell stories and which are an emotional experience for viewers. And at the same time, objects which, through filmmaking, really explore the world and invite audiences and viewers to participate in this exploration. Regularly now, when a new wildlife series is out, the people producing it often make the claim that they film things which were unknown to scientists. I mean, you can look at the last three or four big series, even The Blue Planet in 2000, they made that claim that some of what was shown to viewers was unknown to science. So there is also this attempt at fashioning wildlife television as something which participates in the increase of our stock of knowledge about nature, I think.
Is that true? Did they film things that were unknown to science?
Yes, I think it is a legitimate.
Then that's okay.
Then that's okay. And I think it is interesting because it shows that science is not only something which is done by scientists, but it is something which a lot of different people can participate. Mm-hmm. And it is, in fact, a collective enterprise. Scientists are just one part of it. They are obviously the main part of it because they set the standard of what is true, what is accepted, what is recognized as valid knowledge. But other people can come along and say, look, we've filmed this. This is something you did not know about. Would you like to come over and look at it with us? A story which I think is very telling is the case of Winged Migration, the French film which was released in 2001. And they imprinted birds to teach to habituate them to be filmed as they were flying. Mm.
To fly alongside a microlight aircraft.
Yes, absolutely, that's the one. And they had scientists come along on filming sets. And one of them, a French scientist called Henry Weimer-Kirsch, published a paper in Nature based on observations he had done with his team whilst on the film set. So basically, at that moment, filmmaking becomes an opportunity for scientists to look at their topic anew and make new discoveries and look at it from a different perspective. And likewise, in making of documentaries, you regularly have scientists saying that having been able to participate in that filmmaking project enabled them to learn new things about their animal or their subject. So filmmaking has really managed to enter within the scientific arena and become part of that enterprise. But I think the question that you asked before about are they legitimate claims? Mm-hmm. I mean, you are a naturalist, and you know that I'm sure, I'm not, but I've read naturalists saying that the more time you spend with animals, the more things you see. And I think by becoming intimate with animals, you start understanding them in a specific way, which someone who is just glancing at them may not or will not. And perhaps one of the, not superiority, but advantage of naturalists who spend an awful lot of time in the field over scientists, except field scientists, but even so, is to develop that kind of intimate knowledge of animals, and then they become able to see things which may not occur regularly, but they are instances which repeat themselves over a long period of time. And filmmakers are spending an awful lot of time looking at animals, and most of the time nothing happens, but they just manage sometimes to capture something which is quite extraordinary, and it is something which is real and is part of those animal cultures, if you want. So, yeah, I think there are valid claims.
You're raising a sort of an interesting, sensitive subject there, in a way, because in the world, for instance, of birds, which is the most popular form of natural history, there's a big divide between the bird watchers, the people who go out, the field men, and the academics, who people like yourself in universities writing learned papers and things with fancy statistics and quite unreadable, even the summaries are unreadable most of the time. Anyway, they kind of suspicions of each other, you see. The fellows out in the field can identify everything and can see everything, but they can't rationalize it. Whereas you fellows there, when you go out to the field, you can't recognize even common birds and animals. They say, oh, my God, this fellow's a great scientist and he's in nature. And he doesn't know one thrush from another, you know. What kind of thing is this? But I want to raise an issue here, because what you've described so far is about...
I just want to clarify, you're not actually insulting Jean-Baptiste, are you, Richard?
I maybe I am insulting him, but he doesn't look terribly...
You know he's in the room, don't you?
But the French are used to conflict. You know, they're all into barricades and that sort of thing. The gilets jaunes, you know. He looked rather well in the gilets jaunes outfit, wouldn't he? But anyway, we have to be careful now.
He has a yellow vest on the door.
Has he? Oh, my God, you are a gilet jaune. Oh, I want to take the gloves off, absolutely, now, you know. But anyway, I was thinking it's a kind of Lord Reithy kind of approach now. You want to entertain, you want to inform, you know. And now the scientists have come in and they want to collect data through the cameras. But a new ingredient, it seems to me, began to enter. And it comes from the religious side. You know, you're like the preacher who preached a sermon. He told lovely parables and stories, but at the end of it, there was a prescription, a recommendation. He wanted to excite you to do things or to stop doing things, possibly. Now, this element seemed to have been absent from natural history. You weren't telling the audience, we must be better, we must stop polluting, we must stop reduce our greenhouse gases. When does that element, the prescriptive element, enter the equation?
Yes, so that is a vexed question when it comes to wildlife film and television. People like George Monbiot, for instance, has long been claiming that wildlife television wasn't doing what it should do in terms of educating people about the environment and calling them to act to save the environment. There is some validity in that claim, but at the same time, I think it's a bit missing the point when it comes to wildlife films and television, because they have, as I said earlier, they've developed as storytelling devices. They are visual objects, and the way in which stories are told are through visual things and images, basically. So there is an imperative of telling engaging stories, and so to attract people's attention and keep that attention. When you want to do an object which reports on the states of the environment and calls people to action and invites them to act, and it is a completely different thing, I think. Now, in the last year, we've seen two major television series, Our Planet, which was broadcast on Netflix in 2019, and Seven Worlds, One Planet, which was broadcast on the BBC a bit later. I think it was early 2020. These series really stand out within the landscape of wildlife television because they are, in fact, telling people the world is not going fine and you need to do something about it. So they've been identified as different or as a kind of watershed moment in the history of wildlife television, if you want. The topic they've latched onto is climate change. And what David Attenborough in both series is heard uttering the phrase climate change quite a number of times. And I mean, the plight of animals in relation to climate change is shown in quite graphic details sometimes. And so my hunch, and I've spoken with people like Keith Chollet, for instance, who produced Our Planet, and he explained to me that the reason why climate change was something which could be included within the series was that it enabled filmmakers to tell stories where wildlife conservation, which is the prime interest of wildlife filmmakers, could be presented in a very positive fashion, whereas before, each time wildlife filmmakers were trying to tell stories about wildlife conservation, they ended up doing doom and gloom films where basically they said it's horrible, everything will disappear on Earth, and we have to do something about it. Whereas with climate change, they managed to tell stories where they could say wildlife conservation is something which will help us tackle climate change. And the reason why they could do so is that they came across research by scientists who showed that, for instance, a forest with a thriving population of elephants was much more efficient at capturing CO2 than a forest without elephants. So making the case for the conservation of elephants becomes not something that you say for the sake of elephants or because you think that it's important that there are still elephants in the world, but because conserving elephants becomes a way of fighting climate change. So I think that from now on, because of climate change, somehow climate change is a good thing for wildlife television because it enables them for once to put wildlife conservation center stage. Previously, they had tried to capitalize on the aesthetic value of wildlife to try and entice people to feel concerned with wildlife conservation, but it wasn't something which enabled them to tell positive stories about wildlife conservation.
Do you think that wildlife filmmakers are jumping on the bandwagon?
No, I don't think so. All the wildlife filmmakers I've met and talked to are genuinely concerned with the state of the planet. They love nature, they love animals, and I mean, that's the most important thing to them. And they really see what they do, producing films, as a way to contribute in helping the planet and wildlife conservation.
Okay, then let me rephrase it. Do you think broadcasting organizations are jumping on the bandwagon?
Ah.
I mean, why haven't they done it prior to now? We've been on the radio talking about this for over two decades.
Yes.
And nobody paid the blindest bit of attention to it. We've been talking about global warming, climate change, plastics in our oceans,
yes,
recycling, damage we're causing to the environment. No one cared until now.
Yes. So again, wildlife filmmakers are people who produce things which are meant to be seen and appreciated by audiences, and they don't want to antagonize audiences. It's a complicated balancing act, if you want to, at the same time, present the beauty of nature in a way which won't antagonize people. But I think the game changer has been the appearance of a platform like Netflix, for instance. I mean, there is an element of competition. It is capitalism. We live in that kind of environment, if you want. And they went for the risky approach, I think. And people like Keith Shirley, Alistair Fothergill, were former BBC staffers who are now freelance, and they went to Netflix and said, look, we want to do this. We haven't been able to do that before. Would you like to go ahead with this? And Netflix said yes, and they put the money on the table. And the WWF was also involved in the co-production deal. And basically they demonstrated that it wasn't a problem to talk about climate change on television, and it was not necessary about telling doom and gloom stories, but you could actually tell stories which were positive about wildlife conservation. And so by going to Netflix, they've managed to force the BBC to evolve and adapt to that new situation.
You don't think the BBC would have evolved in this direction at any rate? I mean, climate change is now headline news where it wasn't 10 years ago. Let's be honest about it.
The BBC has engaged with climate change. David Attenborough did a series about the state of the planet in 2000, which was produced by Keith Shelley, who is the producer of Our Planet. And he also did a series, a three-parter, on climate change in 2006, famously after he came out as a converted climate skeptic. But I think the move by Netflix has forced a change of paradigm when it comes to wildlife television.
I can only say, working for a public broadcasting service myself,
yes,
as a radio producer,
yes,
not on the television end, although I do make some television programs from time to time,
yes,
that I don't think it's commercial pressures that have forced us to start looking at climate change. I think it's the news. I mean, it's the news stories. The big news of our generation is that climate change is an issue, and we must respond to that by making programs to educate and inform the public. I don't think we're the slightest bit concerned about Netflix or anybody else, honestly, because
okay,
I've never once heard it mentioned. It is, we have an idea, we want to make a program, here it is. It's very timely, and we should be looking at this. And with regards to bigger decisions made above my head, is that they're saying we must do something. And this is what happened. We had an entire week of television and radio dedicated to climate change not so long ago.
Yeah.
But that was a corporate decision made in the interests of public service broadcasting. That's the truth.
Yeah, I can agree with this. Climate change came in the news. Greta Thunberg was also a major news story.
Mm.
Of course, because the issue is becoming pressing, but I think also the competition dimension should not be disregarded.
No, I wouldn't disregard it, but I think it's more we should do something about this, and a little bit of we better do something about this.
Yes.
And then another little bit of, we have to do something about this. You know, so we should,
yeah,
because it's the right thing to,
yeah,
do. We better, because we're going to look bad if we don't. And we have to, because we need to keep the ratings.
Yeah, okay.
That's my gut feeling.
No, I think it's all three. And you can't just ascribe all the responsibility on one parameter.
Yeah. A final question.
Yes.
Where would we be without it?
That's a good question. Personally, I think that we would miss something. I quite enjoy watching wildlife films, if only because it is such a respite from what we see in the world on a daily basis. It is my dose of comfort, and I mean, it's better than smoking cigarettes or getting drunk. Although one is not exclusive of the other, but and I think the increasing quality of images is also a great thing, because we can see things in ways which our grandparents would never have thought about. So some people are making the argument that it's in fact creating a distance between people and nature, because it replaces the real experience of going into nature. So the flip side of the coin is to say that if we didn't have wildlife television, maybe we would spend more time in nature and looking at our gardens. And I think it's true with everything. There are some good things. And I don't have a television set at home, so I should confess that. And I think we shouldn't spend too much time watching television.
You strike a chord with me there, because I do a lot of courses and give a lot of courses and things, you see, and people are seeing wonderful stuff on television, close-ups, and and when I take them out on Sunday morning for a while, we can't find anything. And when we do, it's 100 metres away, and we're looking through a telescope that they can't focus. So their expectations are raised enormously and can't be fulfilled, and it looks as though I am the one at fault.
Well, I think you'll have to up your game, Richard.
Well, what'll I do? Get a Jodrell Bank thing that goes around with me, or something that I could turn on the wildlife and see. I will be made extinct by wildlife television. I'm gradually becoming extinct. But I don't mind. I've served my purpose. I've passed on my genes, so I can go.
Wildlife television is only good so far as it doesn't take people away from experiencing nature on their doorstep, I think. But it shouldn't be the only way in which people relate to nature. I think But at the same time, some people are living in cities and they are very estranged from nature. So that's their only way of getting to know things that they wouldn't be able to know otherwise. So, yeah.
Jean-Baptiste, Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. You're welcome. And I really loved that conversation. Thank you for interviewing.
More information on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. And don't forget, you can have a listen to the Bergen Whale documentary, which we recorded in 2017. Now, there are fewer things in life as beneficial to the body and spirit as immersing ourselves in the natural world. Whether it's a brisk hike into the hills, kicking back and watching the sun going down, or chancing a quick jump into the sea. Dipping into nature is physically and mentally reviving, accessible to people of all ages and abilities, and enjoyed universally across all cultures. The benefits can be even greater still when, instead of simply moving through the natural world, that we instead try to slow down or even stop and really open our senses to the environment around us. Born out of the corporate culture of 1980s Japan, where distressed city dwellers were taking into the woods to connect with nature, forest bathing is a practice of surrounding oneself with the beauty and healing energy of the natural world. Shirley Gleason is a nature and well-being consultant and runs forest bathing walks through native woodland like that in Knocksink in County Wicklow, where John Bella Riley joined in on a session led by Shirley.
So if you feel comfortable, you can close your eyes, but you can always keep your eyes open. Okay. So we're surrounded here by the most beautiful nature. We have the river behind us, and we've got the beautiful trees all around us with the moss and the ferns. So we're not separate from nature, we're part of nature. We eat food from the soil, from the earth. We drink water from the rivers and from the clouds. So we're part of nature. When we breathe in, the trees give us oxygen. So it's really important to understand that we're not separated from it. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll do a little kind of meditation, a nature meditation. We'll just walk down here. So if you wanted to pick up anything, again, just respecting nature, even some wet leaves, just to really scrunch it up and just inhale it, just through your nose and your mouth, just to see what the forest actually smells like. Oh, wow. Such rich dampness. Fantastic. Let's see.
Wow, yeah.
It's quite strong.
It is, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Much more so than I would have thought.
So the key is to really scrunch it up. Maybe just open your mouth slightly in your nose and just really inhale it. Move it around a little bit and you can really smell the forest.
Participants opening their senses there on a forest bathing walk through Knocksink Woods in County Wicklow, along with inhaling the scents of the forest, listening to the wind in the trees, and touching the textures of the tree bark, participants are also invited into a circle to share their experience.
I came along today because I'm hoping to introduce forest bathing with my colleagues in the Irish National Heritage Park and to embrace what we have on our doorstep, which is a 40-acre primarily heritage but a lot of woodland park. So I'm here today to learn more about it and hopefully be able to develop it.
I write a bit of poetry, so I just kind of thought actually forest bathing is a great way to just become deeper in the connection and maybe see where it goes in myself. And then I work in mental health, so we do walks and people love it, but actually I suppose it's even to support people to become even more connected with the walk that they're on and see how it can help their mental health.
My name is Anthony. I'm chairperson of the Irish Wood Producers. I'm based in Wexford. I'm a farmer, wood owner, and stress has become a serious issue within the farming circles. So I'm here to see what Shirley can do today and see is there potential to operate in Wexford and do something. Thank you.
Nature is kind of like my role model that I aspire to. especially trees. I feel like that actually, because they're kind of, I'm saying solid, but they sway. I feel like that actually, when I feel I'm losing ground a bit, become a bit ungrounded actually, I like to look at one and kind of go, you know, it reminds me to come back. Eventually, maybe not straight away, but I feel like. So it's kind of like my trees are my role model.
One of the reasons I came across this practice was when I worked in social work, it was highly stressful. And I didn't realise that I was doing it at the time, but every year I would try and take a month out and I'd go to the furthest place on the planet. I'd go to the middle of nowhere in Alaska, I'd go to the Okavango Delta in Botswana, I'd go to the Kalahari, I'd go to Yellowstone. And I just didn't want to be around people, I just wanted to be in nature. And I didn't realise that what I was doing was I was restoring myself, everything. I was restoring hope and wonder and restoring my body. And it was only later I made the connection that that's what it was doing.
Shirley, you mentioned there when your work as a social worker got a bit stressful that tapping into nature could have a restorative effect. And what about your clients? Could they too find nature to be healing at a difficult time?
Yeah, so I worked in social work for about 20 years. I would have worked in mental health with adults and children and child protection. I worked in cancer care. So all over the country, private and public health systems. And I always found that some people, nature, they got such solace from nature in times of great distress. So they talk about having a favourite place they'd go in nature, you know, whether it was a bench they'd sit at by the sea, whether it was a walk in the woods by themselves, whether it was to sit in their garden, whether it was a specific tree that they were connected to. And they spoke about how nature really helped and supported them in the time that they needed it. Social work is person, is an environment. That's the definition of social work. You work with people in their environment, but the natural environment was always missing from the social work systems in Ireland. So that's why I branched out into this area, because I felt that there was a need to look at how nature and the environment and people can connect and support each other.
So tell us, just a short definition, what is forest bathing?
Okay, so forest bathing developed in Japan in the 1980s. It's basically to bathe your senses in nature. That's the literal translation, to bathe the five senses in nature.
Are some forests more therapeutic than others? Or what types of qualities do you look for in an ideal forest for forest bathing?
So that's a really important question, because there's a lot of research being done now, especially in Europe. So for us, where it's rich in biodiversity, where it's mixed woodland, you know, they're not all planted forest. Where there's presence of running water is very therapeutic. A lot of research has shown that. Where there's looped flat trails that's accessible for people with mobility issues, where there's a natural soundscape, you know, so there's not a lot of cars, a lot of air traffic, but also certain trees are higher in the monoterpenes, the phytoncides, which is a chemical compound the trees give off. And that's what the research in Japan have looked at, that helps lower the cortisol levels, the stress levels in people's bodies.
Shirley, you guide people through the forest in a slow and meditative manner. Is forest bathing a form of meditation?
It is a form of mindfulness, a natural mindfulness. But it's different than the traditional mindfulness that focuses a lot on the breathing and focuses a lot on the internal process. The purpose of it really is to get strengthen the connection with nature. So it's not about figuring out about your thoughts and focusing on that. It's about making the connection to nature through the senses.
This morning you've been inviting people out here in the forest to listen to the sounds of the woods, to touch the trees, to feel the air on their skin. So the sensory experience is a big part of forest bathing.
It is. The reason is to get people out of their heads and into their bodies, because we spend a lot of time worrying about things in our heads, and how we get into our body is through the senses, the five senses. So that helps calm everything down.
Another aspect is that you invite participants to share their experience in the circle.
Yes, it's a social experience for people, because often people might spend a lot of time in nature by themselves and they don't share their experience. So what we know in modern day society, especially in Ireland, is that people are very disconnected from each other. So what we're trying to do is kind of build a sense of bonding in the group and build that social connection piece. But also for people who are isolated, forest bathing is a really important practice because they come and they can share their experiences and they can be heard.
Are there plans to open dedicated healing forests in Ireland?
We're working towards that. I mean, it could take years, but in other parts of Europe, in Spain, they have specific trails. In Germany, they have specific trails. In Japan, they have trails. So I would really love to see that, because what I know is if there's a lot of dogs on the trail, it can put people off. If there's mountain bikers on the trail, it mightn't be suitable for people to really slow down. I would love to see that happen. There is one private forest that's working towards healing forest status, but that's at the beginning. But for me, I would love to see the public forest trails being developed.
The walk usually ends with a tea ceremony. Yeah. Tell us more about that.
So we usually forage plants along the way, except if it's in a national park where we're not allowed to forage. So just again, respecting the environment. So we might use nettle, dandelion, if there was blackberries, wood sorrel, different things we can use in nature, and we would put into the tea so they can taste. That's the last of the five senses, that they can bring the forest into their bodies through their taste.
Fantastic. Great talking to you this morning, Shirley. Really enjoyed my first forest bathing experience.
Oh, and thanks so much, Don, for coming along and trying it. We really appreciate it, trying to get the word out about the importance of forests for health and to protect forests as well.
And more details can be found on the website rte.ie/Mooney. Now, regular listeners to the programme will be aware that Uachtaráin na hÉireann, Michael D. Higgins, has commissioned a biodiversity audit at Áras an Uachtaráin. This year-long study is being undertaken by a team of ecologists based in Trinity College Dublin, and over the 12-month period, the team will quantify both habitat and species diversity on the 130-acre site, an area that contains both formal gardens, certified organic kitchen gardens, and areas that are managed for biodiversity. The Mooney Goes Wild programme has been actively recording these sessions, and already we have interviewed Margaret Gorney, Chief Park Superintendent responsible for the Áras, who gave us an insight into its history and ecology, and also mycologist Professor Paul Dowding, who pointed out all the various mushrooms found there. Well, tonight, it's the turn of the birds. Recently, Terry Flanagan headed off at dawn with Professor Nicola Marples on a transect walk around the grounds to see which bird species were present.
Nicola, we've just finished our transect walk. What is a transect? Just explain it exactly.
Well, it's very simple. It's basically just a straight line walk through the habitat for about a kilometre at about 2 kilometres an hour, so that you're going slowly enough that you spot all the birds and give them a chance to sing to you. And you try and assess all the birds within a given area. So you have an area either side of the line that you're walking that's about 30 metres each side, because it's quite dense habitat, and you mark all the birds that you detect inside that area and also outside that area in case something exciting flies over.
Now, we've seen lots of birds this morning. I was amazed, for instance, at the number of coal tits that we saw.
Yeah, it surprised me as well. I expected there to be more blue tits and great tits than coal tits, but certainly in Britain you would get a lot more of those two and fewer coal tits. Ireland has a lot of coal tits. It seems to be rather better on this island than on the neighbouring island, which is surprising.
Now, the transect that we've done, as you said, it's a kilometre long, but we went through quite a lot of different habitats. We were in deep woodland, we were in kind of grassland, we went by the lake, so you would be expected to see lots of different birds.
Yes, and all we're trying to do here is have a standard transect through a part of this area, and we've arranged the transects to cover all the different habitats within the garden. So we've got three different transects, and each one, if we do all three each time, then we get a standardised comparison from one month to the next. And all we're trying to do is give all the different birds for different seasons equal chance of getting detected. So we did some in the summer, we will do some in the summer, we did some in the winter. And in the winter we were getting many fewer birds, but they would be different birds. They'd be the birds that are staying over here for the winter, and then those birds will travel elsewhere, will travel further north to breed. And we're now getting birds that come to us to breed that overwinter in Spain or further south. So we swap over a different group of birds each time we come.
But is it also not a case that you're getting more birds now than in the wintertime for a different reason, because we're hearing them singing? I was just watching as you were counting them there this morning. And quite a lot of them, probably two-thirds of the birds that you recorded this morning, were from their call or from them singing. You wouldn't have had that a month or 2 months ago.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely true. So the ones, the resident birds, are comparing between months isn't a good idea because of that. But if you think about it, all of this is just an estimate. So if you are walking through a habitat and you're trying to count how many robins are there, you will get the robins who happen to be male, who happen to be singing and defending their territory, so happen to be adult and are singing when you happen to pass. So all of those things mean that there's many more robins that you didn't detect. Mm-hmm. Now, robins are unusual in that both the sexes sing, but quite a lot of birds, only the males sing. So you're going to miss all the females, you're going to miss all the juveniles, and anybody who hasn't got a territory. So it isn't a way of counting the total number present. What it is telling you the minimum number that were definitely present.
And particularly as well, the species that are here.
Yes, and the species that are here, absolutely. So you get some idea of abundance, and you get a comparative idea of abundance here compared to a different transect in a different part of the habitat, or compared to a different transect in somebody else's habitat, so, you know, outside in Phoenix Park or somewhere else. So the comparison within a given month is fair, but it isn't a total number that's present in the place.
What was your highlight this morning?
Oh, my highlight would probably be the dab chicks, little grebes, because there's two beautiful little grebes in lovely breeding colours sitting on the pond. And I was delighted to see two of them there because it's very likely that they'll breed there.
I'd have to say my highlight this morning was the sparrowhawk chasing across over our heads.
That was
really, really nice. Mm-hmm. And another thing I was amazed at too were the number of herons. There were quite a large number of herons here.
Well, there's a heron breeding colony.
Quite close there at the zoo.
Nearby. And so, yes, absolutely. We get a lot more herons here than you might expect in the middle of a parkland.
And they have become so tame lately. I mean, go back 20 years ago, you couldn't get near a heron. You couldn't get a photograph of a heron. Now you can walk up by them.
Yeah, and they seem to be very adaptable to humans, because I lived in Holland for a while, and in Holland you virtually trip over them. They are absolutely tame and in the middle of the cities everywhere because of all the canals everywhere. So, yeah, they do seem to adapt to being with humans quite easily.
So overall, were you happy with this morning's work?
Yeah, delighted. Yeah, and I'm only halfway through. We've got to do the other half in a minute.
Okay. Then it's time for breakfast.
Yes. Second breakfast.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. Speaking of birds, I've some sad news to report, and that is that this year's broadcast of the Dawn Chorus, scheduled to take place the first weekend in May, is cancelled. And it's on the grounds of health and safety. RTÉ has taken the decision, and rightly so, that we must look after the health and well-being of all of the contributors right across Europe, because there are literally hundreds of people who work on this programme. It's a 7-hour live broadcast from some 30 locations right across the continent. And we have to be mindful of their health and safety. And I want to thank all of our member broadcasting states in the European Broadcasting Union, also to our BirdLife International partners, and right here in Ireland, all of our contributors, and Birdwatch Ireland. Niall Hatch is our ornithological advisor on the Dawn Chorus. He's also the development officer with Birdwatch Ireland. Thank you, Niall. Don't forget, you can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/mini, where you have a very extensive archive of programme material to listen to, especially our documentaries, which will keep you entertained and informed during this period. Until next time, goodbye.